So what I want to do is similar to what we've done the last few weeks, is I want to give people, again, we've seen the text, so I want to give people, let's say, 3 or 4 minutes just to skim through it. Then I want to point out 5 observations, each of which I think is a very nice idea. And then I want to develop a theme, like we do most weeks, to help us understand the significance of this parak. So again, we're in chapter 8. Let's give you 4 minutes to look over the text. And then we will reconvene. Okay, we're going to jump right in again. The goal was just to familiarize yourself with the text, to remind you of what we were talking about. We're talking about the dedication of the Beis HaMikdash. This is one of the most exciting moments, I guess, in all of Jewish history, where we have a recording of the dedicating of the Beis HaMikdash. And if you remember, last week was Hanukkah, so we put a Hanukkah spin on it, but a lot of what we discussed was the structure of the dedication, or 2 weeks ago by now, the structure of the dedication, how Shlomo places a significant emphasis on the Beis HaMikdash as a place of tefillah. He offers prayers, he offers gratitude to Hashem for fulfilling his wishes to his father, for David, to fulfilling the promise that he made to David. If you remember, he went through a whole slew of things about how now that we have a Beis HaMikdash, Hashem, you'll hear our prayers under a whole different set of needs, to vindicate the righteous, to punish the wicked, for sustenance, for rain, for battle, for Gentiles, right, a whole slew of reasons. And then he blesses the people. And then he goes on, they hold a whole set of offerings. And that's the chapter. And again, you get the sense of almost this euphoria that surrounds the dedication of the Beis HaMikdash. What I want to talk about today is the differences between, again, I want to talk about in broad strokes, develop some themes, and then I want to go through some specific pieces. So let's just talk about the broad strokes for now. The difference between the dedication of the Beis HaMikdash and the dedication of the Mishkan. If you remember from 2 weeks ago, we discussed a lot about the differences between the construction of the Beis HaMikdash and the Mishkan. Right? You'll remember that the Mishkan is much smaller than the Beis HaMikdash was. The Beis HaMikdash, at least the way Shlomo HaMelech has been describing the building of it, it's filled with pomp and circumstance and regality and the splendor and majesty. Right, took 13 years to build, a significant construction project. Okay, you'll recall from 2 weeks ago that in the construction of the Mishkan, there's not really a lot of emphasis on Moshe Rabbeinu as the builder. It's Moshe's Bezalel, but at no point do you get the sense that it's Moshe's house. Moshe's doing it, but the Psukim almost bend over backwards to remind us the entire time that Moshe was only doing it because Hashem commanded him. Right? If you recall from Parshiot, Vayakel and Pekudei, we discussed Vayas Kein Moshe, that Moshe was simply following Hashem's orders, and that was very explicit in the Psukim. When you come to our chapters, there is a significant focus on Shlomo HaMelech, that this is clearly Shlomo HaMelech's operation. Okay? If you look to, again, I'll just read you a quick excerpt because I have it and you don't, but back in chapter 6, verse 2, it says, V'habayit asher bana HaMelech Shlomo l'Adonai, that this is the house that Shlomo HaMelech built to Hashem. Verse 12, HaBayit zeh asher ata boneh, right, that you built. In other words, it's all about Shlomo. And we discussed back then that the Midrashim were ambivalent as to whether that's a good thing or whether that's a bad thing. Is it a good thing that there's so much emphasis on Shlomo? Is it a bad thing that there's so much emphasis on Shlomo? And we discussed how perhaps the Psukim were purposefully ambivalent because the text itself isn't sure yet. Right? Where is this all going to lead us? Where is this going to lead Shlomo? Is this emphasis on Shlomo a good thing? Or is it a bad thing because it's going to lead Shlomo astray? And we were kind of left it up in the air 2 weeks ago. Today what I want to discuss is not necessarily the building of the Mishkan versus the building of the Mikdash. And again, there's so much more you could talk. You can read articles about it that the vessels, and we discussed a little bit 2 weeks ago, but the vessels as they appear in the Mishkan are different than they appear in the Beis HaMikdash. The number of them, the description of them, the sizes of them. One of the questions that should be lingering in your mind, it's very troubling, troubles a lot of the commentaries, is what gave Shlomo HaMelech the right to do that? Right, when Moshe built the Mishkan, Moshe built the Mishkan with Hashem telling him exactly how to do it. Build it this way, with this dimension. Shlomo HaMelech, where do we see the instructions that Shlomo HaMelech has given? So A, we don't. We pointed that out 2 weeks ago. Shlomo HaMelech is definitely taking the initiative in this construction process. But number two, we never see Hashem giving him the authority to change the dimensions of things, to change the size of things, the same that change the number of things. That's totally out of the blue. That's a completely innovative process. And again, people deal with, where did Shlomo get this right? Where did he get the audacity to change the construction process? I don't want to talk about that today. What I want to talk about today is the resting of the Shekhinah. If you recall to last week, when we spoke about it in the context of Hanukkah, we pointed out that there are a lot of similarities in the language that's used by the Mishkan and the language that's used by the Mikdash. And last week was all about those similarities. Today I actually want to talk about the differences between the resting of Hashem's Shekhinah in the Mishkan and the resting of Hashem's Shekhinah in the Mikdash. Yeah.
Are you implying that Hashem didn't give Shlomo the directions for the Mikdash that was Shlomo's grand idea?
I'm suggesting that we know that Hashem gave him permission to build it, but we're never told of the significant differences that exist. We're never told where Shlomo got those differences from.
And would Hashem have been happier with the building of a smaller Mishkan like he had in
Correct.
The
Midbar? Yeah. You never get, again, it's one of the anomalies of the text as we have it, is there's just a vacuum. Now again, I always say, the Torah is not a historical text. Torah is not a history book. Right, one of the questions, how do you match up Bereishis with the Big Bang? The Torah was never meant to be a historical work. The Torah is an instructional work. So what it chooses to tell us and doesn't tell us is because it wants us to know things, right? Obviously, conversations happen between Yaakov and his sons that the Torah doesn't tell us about. Just the Torah chooses to tell us certain things because it wants us to know certain things. So here too, perhaps God and Shlomo had many conversations that we're not privy to. But the fact that they're left in or taken out is instructive for us. So it should be lingering in the back of your mind, like, that's interesting. Why didn't Hashem explicitly tell Shlomo, or where did Shlomo get the audacity to make these decisions on his own?
So I think that Hashem wasn't very happy with the way Shlomo approached making this.
So again, if you recall 2 weeks ago, we discussed how there, even Hashem may have been a little ambivalent. Right? Remember, it took a bunch of psukim for Hashem to ultimately put his shechin. Right? It wasn't as seamless as a process as it appeared in Parshas Truma, where right off the gate it was Ve'asuli Mikdash Ve'ashachanti Besocham. You make it, you build it, I'll come. A little more complicated here, because I think the jury is a little bit more out, and I think Hashem was waiting a little bit more to see where all this leads. Again, there is a lot of Shlomo emphasis, and that was the Midrashim that we saw. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? It really depends on how you use it. Yeah?
No.
These are new. In fact, Rashi points out that even the monies that were collected from David HaMelech weren't used. They were filed away. In other words, they had reserves. They had $100,000 in reserves. The capital campaign was so successful that they didn't end up needing to use the reserves. They put the reserves back in reserves. That's what Rashi points out. Okay? So to do that, I want to read for you, and if those who are here from the Parsha class, if you still have your Chumash, we're on page 540, but this is at the end of Parsha's Pekudei. Okay? And at the end of, you don't need it, I'll read it for you, it's okay. But the end of Parsha's Pekudei describes for us the Shekhinah resting on the Mishkan, which is of course a magnificent way to end Sefer Shemot. It's the climax of everything that we're talking about. Listen to the words that are used. The pasuk before, pasuk 33, Vayichal Moshe es hamalacha. So, Moshe finishes everything that he was supposed to do. Next pasuk, Vayechas ha'anan et Oel Moed. The cloud covered the Oel Moed. Uchvod Adonai Maleas ha'mishkan. God's cloud. Remember we said there was a lot of cloud imagery. So God's cloud fills the Mishkan. V'lo yachol Moshe lavo el Oel Moed. Ki shachan alav ha'anan. Moshe can't enter. Similar to the way the Kohanim can't enter in Sefer Malachim. Because the cloud fills it. Uchvod Adonai Maleas ha'mishkan. When the cloud lifted, the Jewish people could travel. In all their travels. And if the cloud did not lift, then again, they wouldn't travel. The cloud during the day, the fire at night. For all of their travels. Right? That's the end of the psukim. Now, parenthetically, if this was a parsha shir on Pekudei, those are very weird psukim. There's a lot of redundancy, which is not necessary, which leads you to believe there's more going on there than we think. But just the pshat, the simple understanding. What is noticeably absent from the Mishkan that you have in the chapter that we're reading this morning? Doesn't mention any cherubs here. The cloud is here, right? It talks about it here. Right? We discussed that a lot last week. Shechina's here. We have clouds. We have fire. Well, let's look at psukim wise. I just read you five verses. Okay, our chapter this morning has 66 psukim. So obviously, there's a little bit more in 66 psukim than there isn't in 5 psukim. So if you had to summarize what's missing in the 5 verses that I just read versus the entire experience that we're reading about in our parsha, what's missing? What? The Shekhinah is there. Talks about the Shekhinah in both places. So the answer I think that's noticeably absent is human involvement. Right, when we talk about the Shekhinah resting over here in Parshas Pekudei, what happens? It says Moshe finishes the construction, and what happens in the very next pasuk? God comes in. Okay, let's look in our chapter now. Verse 51 of the last chapter. Vatishlam kol ha'malacha asher asa melech Shlomo beis Adonai. So far so good. Right? In Sefer Shemot it says that the work ended. And here it says that the work ended. And then, the beginning of chapter 8, the chapter that we're studying today, it takes a dramatic turn. Az Yakel Moshe Shlomo, et Zignei Yisrael, et Kol Rashei HaMatot Nesiei Avot, Shlomo HaMelech gathers everyone together. All of the officers. Then in Pasuk 2, Vayikalu Melech Shlomo Kol Ish Yisrael B'Yerach HaSanim. Right? Again, it's Sukkos. And he gathers everyone together. Pasuk 4. Vayalu es aron ves oel moed. They bring up the aron. And then they bring up sacrifices. Okay? And then they place the aron in the kruvim. And then Shlomo makes a declaration. Pasuk 12. Az amar Shlomo Adonai amar lishkon barafel. Hashem said that he was going to dwell in the cloud. Bano baniti. And he offers this whole elaborate context for the building of the Beis HaMikdash. Right? And then again, then they bring korbanos. Then he offers a prayer. Right? All of that is absent. And all of that seems to be the almost like buttering up or the preparation for Hashem dwelling in the Beis HaMikdash. Right? It almost seems like a prerequisite for Hashem actually dwelling. And in chapter 9 that we're going to see next week, Hashem responds to Shlomo. Right? Hashem repeats it, he responds to it, and culminates the process. That is missing from what we're discussing in Sefer Shemot. So in Sefer Shemot, you have no human involvement. Man builds, that was the Vayichal Moshe Es HaMalacha. In the very next pasuk, God dwells. Okay? And there doesn't seem to be anything that happens in between. There's no prayers. There's no mass tefillah offered. There's no requests from the people. There's no mass gathering of the people. You don't get that sense there. And you don't have hakel, exactly. And there's no response from the people, right? All you know in Sefer Shmot is that this. I mean, you have to picture the sight of this cloud filling a room so that people can't coexist with it. And then how did the psukim end? Le'inei kol beis Yisrael b'chol ma'aseihem. That we're told it happened before them. And you would expect the next pasuk to be the people's reaction to seeing this amazing sight. Doesn't exist. Right here, you have this grandiose building of a Beis HaMikdash, and you have like a much more of a personalized experience. Man builds, that was the last pasuk of last week's, of chapter 7. And then, the very next pasuk, almost even before the Shechina comes, is all about prayer and revelation and Yerushalayim and Beit David. It's a description, it's a context for why the Shechina should come into the Beis HaMikdash. So when you compare them back and forth, I think it's almost like in your face that one, there's a lot of talk about human involvement and human prayer and almost like the personal side of it, right? It's dramatic when you read through the psukim. And Shlomo describes the purpose of the Beis HaMikdash. We discussed a little bit last week. You have a need. You have something that's missing. You go to the Beis HaMikdash. You feel that people misunderstand you. You go to the Beis HaMikdash. It'll clarify for you. You have agricultural challenges. You go to the Beis HaMikdash. Non-Jews, go to the Beis HaMikdash. Right? It's like a beautiful description of the purpose of the Beis HaMikdash. The Mishkan doesn't give that to you. Right? All we know about the Mishkan and its purpose is that we know it's going to be a place of sacrifice, and we know this concept of Ve'asuli Mikdash V'Shachanti B'Socham. And hold on, and we know the rabbis tell us that B'Socham means that not just for Hashem, but it's a dwelling place for you. But the text doesn't tell us that, right? If you look at the text and say for Shmot, so what's the purpose of the Mishkan? Well, it's temporary. It's an Ohel Moed. So you know there's some gathering that's going on there. But Vayikra, which is what leads right after Parshas Pekudei, Vayikra is all centered on what? It's all centered on korbanos. Okay? Here, there is a korban component to it. There's definitely sacrifices. But that's not the bulk of it. You don't get the sense. There's a lot of talk about tefillah and about our needs versus Hashem's needs in us creating the Beis HaMikdash. Right? And again, we talked about that a little bit last week also. So, what do you make of this? What do you make of these differences? Yes, yeah, sorry.
What hits me the most is in the desert they were wandering. This wasn't their country. His father conquered it. They had an empire. It was an empire.
Good, and therefore?
And therefore it was something permanent. And
I'm gonna hold you and I know you're getting there. You're like You're on the precipice. I'm going to take you over that ledge, okay? So again, our question is, why is there such a fundamental difference between what we see in the Mishkan and what we see in the Mikdash? And I want to give you three suggestions. Suggestion number one, I think, is the simplest suggestion, which is that different times, different needs, right? Hashem reacts to the Jewish, or interacts with the Jewish people in the desert significantly differently than he interacts with the Jewish people once they're in the land of Israel. Okay? In the desert, what do we know? We know that Hashem provided the man. We know that Hashem provided water. We know that Hashem provided protection. That was the fire, the cloud, right? We know that Hashem provided almost direct interaction with the Jewish people. It was a miraculous form of divine providence.
It was daily.
It was in your face daily. Every time you went out in the morning to collect the mun, you were reminded of God. You had zero need to take care of anything on your own. Everything was handed to you on a silver platter. Okay? Think about the psukim in Devarim describe that their feet, their shoes didn't wear out. This would save us a lot of money if my kids' shoes didn't get holes on the bottom, right? Their shoes never got holes. Their clothes, they never outgrew their clothes. Their clothes grew with them, the Pesukim tell us. Right? Again, everything was miraculous. Everything was handed on a silver platter. According to many commentaries, that's the at the crux of the sin of the Meraglim. Right? The Meraglim were these big hotshot knockers in the desert. All of a sudden they're like, we don't want to go into Israel. And according to a lot of the commentaries, the reason why they were nervous to go into the land of Israel is because what could be better than sitting around all day, having everything handed to you on a silver platter, and you can learn all day. I mean, like, what's better than that? And all of a sudden you're being told, oh, you're going to go into Israel where you have to work for a living, you got agriculture and all. Who wants that? Let's stay in the desert. So we know that God fundamentally interacted with the Jews differently in the Mishkan than he did in the Mikdash. I mean, than in the desert than he did in Eretz Yisrael. That difference is perhaps reflected in the way Hashem dealt with them in the Mishkan versus the Mikdash. Right in the desert, with you have the Mishkan, everything is miraculous, everything's handed on a silver platter. That's exactly as Hashras HaShechina happens. Man builds. In the very next pasuk, Hashem doesn't require anything of the Jewish people. The very next pasuk is Hashem plops himself down. And the reason why he does that, that's the same way he's been doing everything in the desert. Every aspect of the desert is divinely initiated. God provided the food. God provided the protection. God provided the water. And God provided himself. There didn't need to be any of that effort on behalf of mankind. All of a sudden you come to the Beis HaMikdash, taking place in the land of Israel, where the dynamic of how God is interacting with his people is dramatically different. And all of a sudden it's no longer you flip on a light switch and God comes down. Now you got to work for it. Now there needs to be a lot more divine, there needs to be a lot more human involvement in creating that divine presence. It's not going to happen miraculously. You're going to have to work for it. And that's a lot harder, which is why you have five verses versus 66 psukim. Right? The Jewish people need to put a lot more of their initiative in it. That's suggestion number one. Yeah.
I don't know if this is the point, but the Mishkan served a purpose in the desert. But that was just 40 years. Until Shlomo, you're talking about 2 centuries. So the purpose the Mishkan served in Yisrael was very, very different.
Absolutely. Right. And again, I think that the permanence of the Beis HaMikdash required human interaction. Right? We know that you go into class, right? I used to have a professor, a teacher in high school, that Rabbi Simkovich, that we used to come in, and he was a little out of the box. So sometimes he used to say, give yourself your own grade. Right? However you think you deserved, give yourself that grade. Now then you're like playing mind games. If I give myself an 100, then he knows that I'm just that. But if I give myself like a 90, so then I still get the A, but he realizes that I still see room for improvement, whatever, you know? And then there were the kids that gave themselves like the C's, right? So a teacher comes in like that. Are you going to work hard on that test or not work hard? You're not going to work hard. It's not going to mean anything. The subject matter is going to be in one ear, out the other, right? When you put your kishkas into something, when you put your sweat and tears, when you work hard for something, it's much more everlasting. Okay, so clearly, the permanence of the Beis HaMikdash is connected to the level of human initiative. Okay, so number one is that the way Hashem interacts with his people in the desert is different than in Israel, and that's reflected in the way that the Shechina descends in the Mishkan versus in the Mikdash. Number two is something we discussed in the past, which we're going to talk about again and relate it to our conversation. If you recall the last number of weeks, that those who were here, there's a tremendous amount of opulence surrounding the construction of the Beis HaMikdash. Okay? Almost over the top, with the magnitude and the size and the splendor and the grandeur and the like, it's oozing with wealth. It's dripping with wealth. The finishings on the Beis HaMikdash, and just everything is big and everything is in your face. And if you recall, we discussed, was that a good thing or a bad thing? And like, where was Shlomo heading with all of that? And the answer is that if it's channeled properly, so it can be a beautiful thing. If it's not channeled properly, Well, it can be a disastrous thing, right? We discussed wealth in previous weeks. Is having wealth a good thing or is having wealth a bad thing? Well, you know, I always say, like, halavai, that should be the biggest test I have, right? But no, the answer is the Torah, in every single, in both Tochachas and in many other different places, is very explicit, and very critical, that wealth can lead to significant challenges. Right, exactly, right? Having wealth can lead to complacency, it can lead to arrogance, it can lead to turning away from God, right? So there's an inherent danger in having wealth and having abundance. Okay, and again, the Torah in Bechukosai, the Torah in Sefer Dvarim, in Hazinu, is very explicit about the dangers there. All of a sudden, you come to Shlomo's time period, where we know a couple things. We know there's a lot of wealth. We know there's tremendous peace and security, almost unprecedented, up until this point in Jewish history. Things are really good for the Jewish people. And what's been like lingering with us for a number of weeks is, where's that going to lead? Now, we ultimately know that it leads to bad things. That's what's going to cause the downfall of Shlomo's Malchus, his kingdom, because he has too many wives and too many horses, and like it gets to his head a little bit. But at this point, Shlomo has just built the largest structure known to mankind, basically. Okay? A 13-year operation. And finally they come to the dedication, and Shlomo has two options. They can either just like let it happen, or he can use it as an instructive experience. And when he uses it as an educational experience to remind the people that this is about God. Now you can say that's exactly what happens in the Mishkan. God himself reminds, right? It's a subtle reminder that it's about God. Or you can say that Shlomo HaMelech recognized that sometimes things can't remain subtle. Sometimes it has to be in your face. Right? We had this conversation yesterday. So if you came on a Sunday or a Monday to the campus, so you'll notice there's a youth football league that takes place now on Sunday mornings. And the league just finished yesterday, and I've been reflecting upon the conclusion of the league. And one of the things I realized was I took it for granted that a league that's run by the shul should not be about competitiveness, but should be about talking about sportsmanship and midot and kindness and, you know, making sure everyone's included. It became clear that not all of the parents, what was obvious to me was not necessarily obvious to all of the parents, let's just say. And so one of the things I realized is we have to be more explicit about that. That before every game, we're going to remind the kids about sportsmanship, and we're going to remind the parents about what the purpose of this is, and not to, you know, that your children will be a reflection of how seriously you take things. Sometimes you need to spell things out for people, even things that should be obvious. I think that's what Shlomo HaMelech might be doing here. We look at the Beis HaMikdash, we're like, of course it's about God. It's the second coming of the Mishkan. It's a house for Hashem. Duh, like you need to be a rocket scientist to know that this is about Hashem and the focus should be about Hashem. But maybe Shlomo HaMelech realized with a tremendous amount of wisdom that you need to spell it out for people. And so he takes an entire chapter. And if you look at what the entire chapter is about, it's not private conversations between him and Hashem, which is a lot of what Sefer Shmot is. A lot of Sefer Shmot is Moshe and Hashem conversing back and forth. And we eavesdrop in because we're privy to the Torah, but you don't know what, if you were living at that time, what you were privy to and what you were not privy to. Right? We're not really sure a lot of the times. Here, almost all of this pomp and circumstance, you don't get the sense it's to reinforce the grandeur and splendor of the Beis HaMikdash. You get the sense that it's to like hit people in the face. It's to shock and awe those who are watching. And at every point of chapter 8, it's very clear the emphasis is God. Right? Just look at the headers on the left-hand side. It starts off with, he assembles people. It starts off, it's all about the Aron. And then the Kruvim. The Aron, the Kruvim, the Shulchan, the Menorah, these are like the, these are the ABCs of what the Beis HaMikdash is. Then Shlomo HaMelech connects himself to David in Malchut Beit David. That's not accidental. Right? Again, that's putting the Beis HaMikdash in a historical, spiritual context. Then he goes and he talks about the purpose of the Beis HaMikdash. Wait a second. Sefer Shmos never talked about the purpose of the Beis HaMikdash. Now Shlomo HaMelech is reminding the people, don't think this is just about a big building. Don't think this is just about wealth. Don't just think this is about a connection to Hashem. This is about that relationship to Hashem. And the reason why Shlomo HaMelech, I believe, talks about the role of non-Jews in their participation in the Beis HaMikdash is, again, to reinforce that concept that this is supposed to be a beacon of light to the world. Even the non-Jews are going to want to come and use this as their house of worship. Because that's what the Beis HaMikdash is. The Beis HaMikdash is a reflection of God in reflection of our values to the world around us. Right? And again, then when Shlomo HaMelech, even when he gives the bracha to the people, think about the words that he uses. Just flip to Pasuk 54. 55, excuse me. Top is 827. Pasuk 55 there. Vayamod vayivarech es kol kahal Yisrael, kol gadol emor. So Shlomo Melech now blesses the people. And how does the bracha start? Baruch Adonai Asher Natan Menucha Le'amo Yisrael. What translate those words for me? Bless Hashem. Now he could have blessed Hashem for a lot of things right now. What would I have probably thanked Hashem for? Thank Hashem for the wealth. Thank Hashem for the peace, right? So Menucha, what's the peace for? That's the question. What's the wealth for? What's the peace for? The answer is it's all good if it's channeled toward divine service. Right? The corollary to this is in the bracha that Yaakov is going to give in next week's Parsha to Yisachar. Yisachar, of course, we have Yisachar Zvulun. Zvulun is the one who goes out to work. Yisachar is the one who learns Torah. And what's the bracha that Yaakov gives him? Vayar Menucha Kitovu. He saw Menucha, he saw rest, that it was good. In other words, rest, tranquility, peacefulness, peace with your neighbors is good when it's channeled toward learning, toward divine service. That's why that's the bracha that's given for Yisachar. Okay? And that's exactly why Shlomo Melech, he begins the bracha, right? Thank you, Hashem, for the menucha. In other words, right? I'll read the text and then I'll translate. Baruch Hashem asher nasan menucha l'amo Yisrael. Translate. Thank you so much, Hashem, for giving us this beautiful building, and for giving us this wealth, and for giving us the opportunity to build this, so that, right? Kichol asher diber lo nafal davar, we didn't miss. Yihi Adonai Eloheinu imanu kasher haya im avoseinu al yazveinu val yichenu. It's all about our relationship with Hashem. That now that we have a permanent home, let the relationship with Hashem be equally permanent. Lehatos levaveinu elav, to draw our heart, not away from Him, this menucha, this rest, this tranquility, all of this wealth is not to draw us away from it, it's to draw us toward Him. Lalechet b'chol drachav lishmor mitzosav v'chukav u'mishpatav asher tziva es avoseinu. Right? This whole purpose, everything that exists here, is so that I can connect to you. It's the equivalent of a parent when he bequeaths a trust fund to his children. He sits them down first and says, don't think I'm giving you this money so you can go off on vacations and you can live a, you know, exorbitant life. No, no, no. I'm giving this to you so that you can go learn in Kolel. I'm giving this to you so that you can go do chesed. And I'm building you this house so that when people need guests, you're the place that they're going to host, right? That's exactly what Shlomo HaMelech is doing here. And so perhaps this entire elaborate discussion is Shlomo almost trying to get ahead of the dangers and risks that are inherent in so much opulence and wealth and tranquility and peacefulness. And Shlomo is telling them, please, use this for good. Use this to draw you toward Hashem, not, God forbid, to draw you away from Hashem. Okay?
Rabbi, wouldn't you say he was successful carrying this out in his generation, in those 40, 50 years? It was only after his death that everything broke.
Well, we're going to have to see. It's not so clear. Okay. Well, the jury will be out on that. Yeah.
You said that non-Jews also came to the...
Correct. The answer is verse The answer is verse 60. Okay, we were just about up to that. I was going to stop reading, but now I'll continue reading. We're up to verse 58, so we'll read 59. Ve'yu dvar elai ela shirit chananti lifnei Adonai krovim el Adonai Eloheinu yomam v'layla la'asos mishpat avdo mishpat amo Yisrael dvar yom b'yomo. In other words, we should be worthy to do Hashem's will. Pasuk 60, leman dat kol amei ha'aretz ki Adonai hu Elohim einod. Right? The purpose of, remember we discussed a few weeks ago, the purpose of such a magnificent structure is to let the world know that God is Hashem, that He's in control. Right? Why do we have beautiful shuls? It's not just because, you know, we like campuses. No, it's because a shul is a reflection of God. And in when shuls are beautiful, people associate beauty with God. When you see someone who's schlocky and the bill, that doesn't make you want to come close to that, right? God isn't just the God of the Jewish people. He's the God of the world. We believe we have a unique relationship there. But we say on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur throughout the Aseret Me'tshuva, right? V'chein tein pachtecha, that part of the la'asos ritzoncha b'levav shalem, that part of, we say in Aleinu every day, right? This, we say this, basically this pasuk in Aleinu, is we want to let the world know how great Hashem is. That's our duty. That's Yakir V'yedu, right? That's the whole purpose, is to make the world recognize. Okay, that's suggestion number two. So again, suggestion number one was the difference between in Israel, outside of Israel. Suggestion number two is to prevent it from getting to their head. Suggestion number three is to build upon an idea that we started with and we discussed previously, which is the Moshe Shlomo dynamic. When it comes to the Mishkan, everything is about the Mishkan itself. Moshe is obviously front and center, but he's definitely more behind the scenes. It's never about him. He's never the focal point of it. In fact, again, as we discussed, the psukim bend over backwards to minimize Moshe as almost like a deified figure, right? And the Torah does that in a number of different places. Part of our concern here is that with the Mikdash, up until now, it's all about Shlomo. And you have, again, you have to put yourself in that time period. Here's a guy, he's David's son. So off the bat, he's got street credibility, right? He militarily has been very successful. He already put down a couple of coups. He killed off any of his enemies. So he's got, you get the sense, like a strong, solidified kingdom. He has peace on all of his borders. He's got people up north basically banging down his door to do business with him. He's made Israel great again. I mean, that's really what he's done, right? They want to do trade more, right? He's got peace. Everyone wants to marry into him. He's got wealth. He's got construction, right? We're going to make our roads great. He's got construction projects going on. He's got a house for himself, a billion. Oh, and by the way, he's smart. Right, we know he's a very wise individual. That was the with the two women, and so we know that this is a pretty impressive guy. His approval ratings are through the roof. Okay? And that coupled with the fact that his name keeps getting mentioned, so there's an inherent danger there as well, which is that it's all gonna go to Shlomo's head. And that people are gonna perceive this all as Shlomo's project and not their own. Okay? Think about the following. When we build the Mishkan, how are things brought? How do they collect the items for the Mishkan? Think all the way back to the beginning of Parshas Truma. Who said that? People volunteered, right? They were encouraged to do it. Vayichuli truma me'es kol ish asher yidvenu libo. What does yidvenu libo mean? Whose heart, article changes, whose heart motivates him. In other words, you're inspired to participate in this project. It's basically saying, we're putting out a capital campaign. Whoever wants to give, give. Right? No more shul dues. Put it this way. Churches do this, by the way. Churches don't have dues. They pass around the bucket and they make a gazillion more dollars than shuls do that have shul dues. Right? The answer is if we didn't have shul dues, the lights wouldn't turn on. But right? But that's the church model, a very successful model, is they don't charge dues. It's all volunteer. It's tithing, it's volunteering, though. So they pass around a bucket, and you feel inspired. By the rabbi's, by the pastor's sermon that morning, you're going to dump something in the bucket. That was Parshas Truma. That's how the Mishkan was built. It was people putting in their, like, kishkas into it. How does it get built in Sefer Melachim? How do they build the Mikdash? Are they volunteers? No. If you recall, we have language of tax. Remember, there was a massive tax. We have language of slavery, basically. Remember that for 12 months they would work, and then they would go back to their families for a little bit of time. There was this, basically a, like an indentured slavery, you know, you were recruited into the army, inscripted into the army, basically. And you were forced to do certain jobs on behalf of the kingdom, okay? You had officers, remember? There was this whole construct of officers and a chain of command, right? It was like very regulated in how you were giving and what you were giving and when you were giving and your time and your money. I'll throw it out to you. Which one are you going to feel more inspired and passionate about? The one where you're forced to do it or the one where you're voluntarily inspired to do it? Inspired to do it. So by our Mishkan, we have the people are volunteering for it. It's not one man show. It's like the people are collectively coming. It's a grassroots operation. Then you come over to the Mikdash and it's all about, it's top down instead of bottom up. It's all about Shlomo. Shlomo, Shlomo, Shlomo. All I got to hear about all day is how great Shlomo is. And then he's forcing me to make him look good. Right, again, I'm dramatizing this, but right? He's forcing me to build his empire that he's taken all the credit for. So you get the sense that Shlomo picks up on this. Because I'm going to point out one word that has yet to appear in all of Sefer Melachim, all seven chapters, but in just chapter 8 appears seven times in one form or another. Anyone want to guess what that word is? Or what that root word is? I'll give you a hint. Anyone want a hint? The hint is that it's the second word of the parak. Kuf, hey, lamed. Hakel, vayakel, vayakilu, right? What does that word mean? To gather. Now we know we have an entire parsha in the Torah. Vayakel, right? Vayakel, why is it called vayakel? Let's think about that for a second, right? Vayakel Moshe et kol adap bnei Yisrael. Moshe gathered together because it was a collective project. So Moshe gathers together the entire people. Okay, up until this point, there's no, that root word of kuf, hey, lamed, does not appear in the text. All of a sudden, poof, it doesn't just appear, but it appears with a vengeance. Seven times, Shlomo HaMelech emphasizes gathering, gathering, the people as a whole. And perhaps you could argue that Shlomo has now, again, whether consciously changed his attitude, whether this was his plan the whole time, again, who knows? But clearly there's a shift in the focus of the text from just Shlomo to now involving the rest of the people. Okay? That word vayakel means to gather. The very first thing Shlomo Melch does on dedication day is he gathers everyone together because he wants people to feel that they are participants, not just bystanders, in this project. They were forced to work.
You worked for something for years. It's yours. It's mine. This person contributes thousands of dollars to this shul. So, I mean,
not when it's forced. Here, you don't get the sense. The word vayakel does not. It's a softer word. Again, you have to look at the words that were used previously. Tax is a very strong word. Indentured slavery, basically. These are strong words. Vayakel means that we're having like a public celebration that the entire community is invited to. That gets me excited. That makes me euphoric about what's about to take place. I'll share with you one other pasuk that I noticed after I saw this idea. Pasuk 62. As they're giving the sacrifices, so I'm anticipating Shlomo giving the sacrifice, based on what I've known from previous chapters. And yet the pasuk is very explicit. V'hamelech v'chol Yisrael imo zovchim zevach lifnei Adonai. That's a dramatic shift in the tone of the text. V'chol Yisrael imo. Everyone is participating along with him. It's not just Shlomo. It's not just the officers. It's not even the Kohanim. It's everyone now has the opportunity to participate in this beautiful event. So again, I think those are three, each one a little different, suggestions as to how you describe the difference between what we saw in Sefer Shmot and what we saw in Sefer Malachim. Either option one is that Hashem interacted with the people different. Option two, right, the difference in Israel versus in the wilderness, and that's reflected in how Hashem Shekhinah resides. Number two is perhaps there was a fear that Shlomo was trying to get ahead of, which is to remind people that this beautiful structure is only a means to an end, not the end in and of itself. And the end, obviously, is a relationship with Hashem, and that's why he goes through all these tefillahs and these descriptions to remind people. And option number three is that the whole purpose of this public gathering, which was unnecessary in Sefer Shmot, but is very necessary here, it's to bring everyone into the project. For whatever reason, Shlomo HaMelech felt that it was easier to streamline things the way he did it, but at a certain point, you got to bring everyone on board. You got to make everyone feel like they are part of the process. There's more to discuss, but I think we've exhausted chapter 8. Next week, we're going to jump into chapter 9, which is Hashem's response to everything Shlomo discussed, and then really the beginning of the entire operation of the Beis HaMikdash.